Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 223, I am joined by Dr. M. Ali Khan and Ajay Kurian to discuss the April 2020 edition of Retinal Physician. We recorded this in the midst of the shutdown nationally due to COVID-19. I'm recording this intro today on March 27, 2020. This episode will release tentatively on April 1st, 2020. And again, we do some mentions. I make a disclaimer at the beginning that I don't want to talk about COVID-19 to give people a welcome distraction, but on some level, many of the things we discuss are very relevant, and I'll keep breaking my own rule and bringing it in. I hope you all are doing well and are safe during this tumultuous time. I thank you all for what you're doing, the services you're providing, the things you're doing in your communities to keep COVID-19 at bay, whether it's social distancing or the things you're specifically doing in your practices to make this a better time. Remember, financial disclosures for all of the contributors will be listed in the episode description. And you can also claim CME credits by clicking on the link in the episode description to take you to the AAO website. We'll be trying to release episodes both related to COVID-19 for updates as well as to continue our education and keep you, maybe it's sometimes a welcome distraction to think more about retina topics than about epidemiology and infections and things that are really relevant to not just physicians but all American citizens right now. And remember, all our prior episodes, 223, including this one, can be found on our website, retinapodcast.com. Here's Dr. Khan and Dr. Kurian. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be rejoined by two of my close friends and colleagues. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. M. Ali Khan from Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Ali, welcome back.
Thanks, Jay, for having me.
And Dr. Ajay Kurian from Wills Eye Hospital. Ajay, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Jay.
So I've started adding date tags to when we record this. We're recording this March 26, 2020. With COVID-19, things will be relevant. So if something really bad happens tomorrow and this comes out in a week, it's not that we didn't mention it. It's because we didn't know it was going to happen. We recorded with Ajay and Yoshi Unikawa yesterday, Ali, a little bit about COVID-19, what you guys are doing. So we're not going to talk about COVID-19 here. We're going to make it a COVID-19 free zone as of now, and try to give people something to distract themselves a little bit, hopefully, and continue to educate themselves. We're going to release this April 2nd, 2020, and this will be a review of the April 2020 issue of Retinal Physician. Again, this is not a journal club. We are not just going to regurgitate what's in these articles. They are found for free online at retinalphysician.com, but use them as a jumping off point for discussion. So the first article we're going to talk about is titled Biosimilar Therapies in the Treatment of Neovascular Age-Related Macular Degeneration, with the subtitle Biosimilar Drugs Could Bring Significant Cost Savings to Retina Therapy. This was written by Shruti Arapalli and Alexander Rachitskaya from Cleveland Clinic. And I'll just quickly summarize. There's discussion of the treatment burden for macular degeneration, and biosimilars essentially could have the benefit of a significant reduction of costs. And there's ranibizumab biosimilars that are being looked at, and razumab has been approved as a biosimilar to ranibizumab. And then aflibercept, there are no approved biosimilars, but they are in development. And bevacizumab biosimilars, because of the compounding issue, also the lower cost of bevacizumab, maybe there isn't the same market for a biosimilar, although there is a biosimilar in the oncology field, which is interesting, which is approved by the FDA for oncology indications. So theoretically, you could compound it and use it off-label. Ali, biosimilars is something people talk about a lot. We'll talk about, there's some business implications for biosimilars, but let's first talk about from a medical standpoint, your thoughts on biosimilars and how they'll fit into our current treatment paradigm?
Yeah, I think one of the things the article does a good job is explaining how a biosimilar is different from, say, a generic medication. So I think when we think of generic medications, it's the same molecular structure of the existing drug currently available. but a biosimilar is not the same thing. It's actually not the same exact molecular structure. It's sort of reverse engineered to produce the same endpoint. So they're cultivated from cell lines. And, you know, because of that, there could be some concern about slight variation in the end product and also some, you know, immune-related responses that I think will be interesting to see if that actually plays out in the real world. So, you know, the article points out that they're relevant and that they could introduce competition and cost reduction in the market. So if I think they were available and they were as effective as our current drugs, I certainly would consider using them similar to the way that we use bevacizumab.
Ajay, your thoughts and perspectives?
Yeah, I think Ali did a great job summing it up, but especially the difference between the biosimilars and the generics. I think the price point is going to be the biggest thing that drives adoption of this, and some of it might be external to the actual physician's preference, as we're seeing with step therapy being mandated across many different insurance carriers. If they're banning step therapy for drugs that are existing right now, then certainly if there's evidence of these biosimilars being as efficacious, I would anticipate there being step therapy for these agents as well, if they're priced significantly lower than the current modalities that we have right now.
So I think a relevant issue we'd have to mention is there's a financial standpoint to this. I think that financial for the system, obviously much more cost effective to use biosimilars. Right now, one of the big things is that's a known thing is that practices that use a large amount of on-label drug, there is sort of a quote-unquote bulk discount / rebate program if you do that. And that's actually a significant revenue stream that helps support these practices often. With biosimilars, we don't know what that would look like, but I would assume that would kind of change things. Obviously, we want to use best therapies. If they're equal therapies efficacy-wise, we should use them and reduce costs. Ali, it's a tricky issue to talk about, but any thoughts on that standpoint from the standpoint of incorporating it when a practice already has kind of a setup to purchase a large amounts of one drug?
Yeah, I think that's more of the kind of the business consideration of how these drugs come into play from the actual practitioner side of things. I agree. I mean, I think there's a lot of practices, large practices, that if you do inject a large volume of a certain drug, you do have certain financial incentives or benefits from that, and how that would actually affect the adoption of lower cost overall medications, I think, remains to be seen. I think there's some practices even are hesitant to maybe start using a brand new on-label medication until they can sort out the internal finances of that as well. So I think that's going to be relevant to see how many large practices will adopt these drugs. So I think you're right.
Well, and Ajay, I'll let you comment in a second. We're going to kind of tie this into our next article, which is update on longer-acting anti-VEGF therapies by Michael Sunger and Effie Rahman. This article talks a little bit about some of the options in trial right now, including faricizumab, abicipar, peckle, and then they talk about the port delivery system, KSI-301, things I talked about with Farina Ali recently that were in the last article, Opthea or Opt-302, and then gene therapy, Regenix Bio, and Enverum, which we've talked about before. And they do have a note about brolucizumab, which is the only FDA-approved option in this in October 2019. And we had a conversation recently about the inflammatory events with brolucizumab, and we'll talk about that in actually a second. But Ajay, first, just to comment, you have all these different options in development. I think it's premature to, with none of these through phase 3 trials or approved, to really talk about any of these options as viable. But when you talk from a practice perspective, how do you think that, let's start with the business side before we get to the medical side. If we could get to a point where we have 7 or 8 kind of different options for treatment, how are we going to incorporate that in a typical practice setup? You know, I work out of a hospital. We'll have all these drugs available through our pharmacy. But I'm curious, again, we talked about practices kind of stocking in bulk and storing these in refrigerators. How are practices going to manage to keep up and store multiple expensive drugs from multiple different companies and kind of keep a decent inventory of all of these in a financially viable way?
You know, it's definitely a pretty big logistical hurdle that would be present if we wind up having so many options. Fortunately, at this point, we've always been able to adapt for it because all these options are not coming out at once. And so we went from having sort of 2 options and 3 options, now a 4th option. I think that to certainly, if it keeps increasing, it's going to require a larger amount of space and a more detailed inventory system to be able to handle all of that, which certainly contributes to some of the overhead associated with administering these medications. On the other hand, some of these medications that are being looked at for the future, as well as brolucizumab, tout the potential for needing less injections, essentially, for every patient. And so there could be a space reduction in your sheer volume of medications that you need that could be offsetting the need to have multiple different vendors.
Ajay, and before I bring Ali in to talk about that, thoughts on, from your perspective, which of these pathways are you most excited about as someone with a basic science background?
You know, the gene therapy applications of being able to produce a VEGF, an anti-VEGF, essentially treatment in your own eye is very exciting. I remember hearing about that concept a while ago when we were residents even, and just thinking how that would be such an amazing thing to accomplish. And I think, you know, we still need to see what the safety is. There certainly are concerns about VEGF blockade and progression of geographic atrophy and macular degeneration, for example. And I think that some of those concerns will only be borne out with very long-term trials. And so far, the trials that are here to date are not at that level of duration that we can actually look for some of those potential downsides. But if we are able to actually utilize that in a relatively easy fashion, it could be a dramatic game changer for delivery for these medications.
Ali, your perspective on these medications and anything Ajay said you want to add on?
Yeah, I think, you know, the focus on maybe quarterly dosing in a lot of these drugs, you know, brolucizumab clinical trial design included quarterly dosing, same with the abicipar trial. So I think, you know, these trials trying to aim for a 12-week interval is relevant given the treatment burden issue. And then I agree with Ajay. I think the most interesting from a scientific background are the gene therapy trials. So I think everyone will be excited to see how the phase two studies go, particularly given that there's the surgical aspect, how you kind of implement that in practice may be even more challenging, but, you know, worth a try if it really does have the durability and safety that it may.
Well, I think that there's a cynical side to that too, Ali. I think that quarterly dosing as a trial endpoint makes a lot of sense because in what we've seen is other drugs, for example, like Clearside, when they looked at suprachoroidal steroid versus anti-VEGF, I think it's really hard to beat anti-VEGF from an efficacy standpoint. So if you can show some sort of equivalence or non-inferiority with a longer duration, that may be a more reasonable way to try to get a positive outcome. A lot of this is how they designed the trials too. And I think that, and I'm breaking my own rule because we promised not to talk about COVID-19, but I think COVID-19's kind of highlighted one of the things we were talking about via text yesterday. One of the biggest things with social distancing and reducing our volumes is the number of patients we have who are kind of on persistent treatment right now. That reflects an unfilled need. And so if we had one of these options, it would make a situation like now where you could say, hey, this patient doesn't need to come in right now because they can go X amount of months without treatment. It would really reduce the treatment burden, reduce exposure, and improve social distancing too.
I was just saying, yeah, the longer we have that we could go in between injections, the better in situations like this. Obviously, this is kind of an interesting times that we are in regards to the injections during COVID. I think there's a range of opinions on, you know, what is considered an emergency versus what is not considered an emergency. So having some drugs that can give us a little bit longer, I think, would be welcomed by all.
Yeah, I was just going to say, even the absence of a viral pandemic, I think our patients are significantly burdened by needing to come into the office so often, for especially those patients who are like the Q4 week ones, so you just can't extend, because a lot of times they wind up needing to have a family member take off to bring them into the office, and then that can also impact compliance with visits and things like that. And so I think overall, if we can have anything that helps with duration of effectiveness, I think it would be welcomed by patients and the treating docs.
Yeah, I think that we got to talk about brolucizumab just because it was mentioned here. And I will start, we list disclosures with the episode. I will be fully open about disclosures. I've got no disclosures with the Novartis. But I have consulted Regeneron, which obviously a competitor for Novartis and BioView. I'll just read what was written here. They talk about how in February 2020, the American Society of Retina Specialists notified its membership that since the FDA approval of BioView, the organization has received reports of 14 cases of vasculitis after BioView administration, of which 11 were designated by the reporting provider as occlusive retinal vasculitis. And I don't think this is news to any of us here in the podcast or anyone listening at this point. I think in a way, everything else that's happened in the world has appropriately kind of reduced the amount that people would be talking about this. I think this would be one of the high topics for retina meetings and retina webinars and the such right now if they weren't all being held because of the things going on in the world. But what I would ask you guys, right now, Novartis is still producing Beovu. They are still standing by the drug, though they're advising to monitor for inflammatory events and not to use in patients with active inflammation. Ali, are you using Beovu? Is anyone in your practice using Beovu at this point? What are your thoughts on the drug going forward in the future?
I personally am not using Beovu. There are people in our practice who are using it, and we're still involved with some of the currently enrolling clinical trials, even though there's now discussion of potentially putting that any sort of recruitment and ongoing injections on hold, given the concern for the occlusive vasculitis. I mean, from my personal point of view, I'm not planning to use this drug unless this issue is a little bit more borne out and we understand why this is happening. I don't know why there would be a reason to use this drug as opposed to one of our alternatives if we have an unclear safety issue. So, similar to, thrombogenics and Jatria, I think people placed on hold until there's more clinical study. And I think that's going to be the case with the majority of retina specialists as well.
Ajay, thoughts on brolucizumab before we move on to the next article?
Yeah, I'm pretty much in the same boat as Ali. I think at this point it would definitely be helpful to get some more data to see how these patients are faring and how much of a problem this actually is. I think that there's always some concern when you're rolling out a brand new drug that you might get some side effects or some adverse events that weren't in a clinical trial that now are borne out in much larger commercial adoption of the medication. And we're certainly seeing that here to some degree. It's definitely a very scary thing speaking to some of the physicians who took care of patients who experienced this. And then, speaking to other patients who speaking to other physicians who have treated patients without any issues, they've been very happy with the results that they've seen. But I think in light of the reports that are out there, for me personally, I'm holding off until we get some more data.
And I would agree with both of you. That's kind of been my perspective as well. So the next article was titled Real World versus Clinical Trial Data for Retinal Drug Regimens. This is a Q&A with Charlie Wyckoff, who's been on the podcast before, with Jen Ford, who's the Senior Managing Editor of Retinal Physician. And actually, it's pretty interesting. I think Charlie did a really good job talking about trial data versus what he kind of does in his practice and what people do in real-world data studies. It's a good read, and I think it kind of bridges the gap that's sometimes present between what a trial looks like and what we actually are doing day to day. Ajay, reading this and kind of your impressions, what sort of things do you think? So they mostly talk about wet AMD here. What sort of things from the trials do you think that, in a real-world sense, we could improve at, right? So do you think that undertreatment is a significant issue in the real world? Do you think that maybe the trial's overtreated? Because some of the data suggests that there's some letters lost in real-world data versus trial data. That's become, again, I'm going to break my rule. That's become an issue now with COVID-19, is how long can you extend someone? Should you cancel someone's appointment because of risk versus keep them on a fixed interval? What are your kind of thoughts on how to manage, first of all, in a normal situation and now in kind of a pandemic situation?
So I'm mostly a treat and extend for patients, and from that survey data, I could see that's the most commonly subscribed treatment paradigm for retina specialists. There certainly are a lot of papers that are out there showing worse real-world outcomes. One thing that I always wonder with those studies is what the impact of refractive error is, because we certainly aren't routinely refracting the patients in our clinics in the real world, but in the studies, they're undergoing like a very detailed refraction. And at least from just from referring patients to studies, I'm always amazed at how many patients don't meet the visual acuity criteria for different studies after their refraction, despite having a huge amount of fluid and things like that. And so I do always wonder about that when we're looking at how badly people do in the real world studies. That being said, I do still anticipate, even if you're correcting for the refractive error, some degree of worse outcomes in real world compared to the clinical trials, because you really have everything going for you in the clinical trial. There's somebody there who's trying to remind you about your appointments and will follow up if you miss it. There's transportation that's often provided. Sometimes there's even financial payments for coming to the visits. There's all sorts of motivators that are there, and often patients who enroll in a clinical trial are motivated themselves. And so then when you compare that to other patients who have real life burdens that make it difficult for them to come to their regularly scheduled visits, there's all sorts of reasons to not be getting the injections as often as you do in a clinical trial, even if the treating physician wanted to treat them more frequently. And so I do think that there's certainly some degree of under-treatment that's happening, but I feel like a lot of that is due to issues with just coming as frequently as you would need to fully treat according to the clinical trial playbook sometimes.
That was really, really well said. Ali, what sort of things would you add on top of that? Again, we were having this conversation a little bit via text yesterday with a few colleagues.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what Ali was saying. I mean, I do extend as well. I think, referencing this specific article, that one of the questions that was asked to Dr. Wyckoff is, what are the variations in how retina specialists apply treat and extend, which I thought was pretty interesting. Like the number of loading doses, you know, tolerance for any type of fluid, you know, subretinal fluid has been shown to maybe be not so bad and can be tolerated. And also, what is the maximum interval that you can extend, and when do you decide to stop and switch to a PRN? So I think the questions that I think are interesting, you'll see a lot of variation amongst treating physicians about particularly what's the longest interval to go between, and also when do you consider switching to our PRN approach?
Yeah, I completely agree. And Ajay did a really good job summing up the day-to-day kind of real reasons why someone may not want to come in, and maybe these things may not be, when we talked about longer acting agents, things that we have to keep doing indefinitely for 5 or 10 years, and these won't be issues for us in 5 years if we have longer acting therapy. The last article, well, titled Non-CNV Predictors of Success of Anti-VEGF for AMD, it's by Harkaran Rana and Daniel Kiernan. And this is, ironically, they did a great job talking about a very dry subject, no pun intended, but kind of just going through things that predict visual outcomes and the different variables. Biggest things are, you know, age is a predictor, presenting vision, and then presence of subretinal fluid. And things that predict how often you get treated include subretinal fluid amount. And there seems to be some genetics there that could be evaluated in the future. But again, I think this is interesting to think about. I think it's interesting to kind of think about when you're counseling a patient for prognosis. I don't know if this necessarily changes anything from a management perspective, but good things to think about. And maybe if we get better genetic information in the future, that will help guide our therapies, especially if we have different therapeutic options. Ali, I don't know if you have anything else to add on this one.
No, I mean, I thought it's relevant because I think the number of people who actually get an initial fluorescein has dropped quite a bit. I think everyone's using OCT maybe to initiate treatment and then considering doing a fluorescein later. So those prior, you know, CNV predictors of success maybe aren't as, you know, currently relevant. So if there were other predictors that we could get an idea of who may get worse, similar to the way that we look at certain types of drusen or reticular type drusen to see who may advance to more, you know, advanced forms of AMD, I think all of us would welcome that sort of predictive value. So certainly worth looking into.
Ajay, final thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's some of the things that they talked about are things we don't really think about in our everyday practice, but certainly as the ease to get gene testing, as well as the potential for more therapeutic options, like we were talking about before, are available, we might be able to discern certain patients who do better with individualized treatment plans. But I think we're still a ways away from being able to apply that to our clinic directly. But it's always great to think about these things.
Well, thank you, guys. Ajay, last time you were on, which was all of 24 hours ago, I ended by saying we have NBA withdrawal and that you asked you for your favorite Knicks moments, and you tormented me by talking about Allen Houston's shot in 99, which was pretty bad visceral memory. Ali, given the NBA withdrawal you're going through now, if you're going down the rabbit hole on YouTube, what is the number one or number two Lakers moment that you think about, or you like to watch or think about? What's your favorite Lakers memory of all time?
Of all time? Wow. I think that's rough. There's too many eras. But I would say of the Shaq and Kobe era, I still think the Game 7 against Portland, Western Conference Finals, the Kobe to Shaq lob to get us to the finals in our first championship is up there. Also, big shot Bob, Robert Horry draining a three at Sacramento, just dagger in the heart of Sacramento, including my wife, who is from Sacramento. I will never forget that. I think the entire stadium was erupted. Anyone who was watching at home, including me at USC on college campus, was going nuts. So that might be my favorite.
You know, what's funny, that Horry shot is one of my worst memories to watch. It's so painful every time I see it. If you were anyone who's rooting against the Lakers, it's like the ball just bounces perfectly to like the right spot. That series tanked my, way back when we used to take SAT 2s, absolutely tanked my SAT 2 bio exam, because I took it the morning after game 6, I think it was like a Friday, and I definitely stayed up watching the game and definitely did not sleep afterward. I didn't learn zero biology watching that game. But
I think it tanked the city of Sacramento as well. So you're not alone.
I feel for the city of Sacramento, because Big Shot Bob earned that nickname against the Knicks when he made some of those shots in the finals. So
before
there was Sacramento, there was New York.
You know, I've been going down the rabbit hole. Is I really miss watching the Warriors. I know the Warriors are like a front runner team, but I really miss watching Steph Curry and Klay Thompson play basketball. That's what we just took it for granted. They were just so much fun to watch. Andre, you asked me my favorite Heat memory. Do you have any guesses what it is?
Oh, man. I don't know. You guys have had a good run, but probably one of the D-Wade Shaq finals, I would say.
So my two favorite Heat memories, number one, was Tim Hardaway going absolutely insane in the third quarter against the Knicks in 1997. There's a great YouTube clip called Tim Hardaway Catches Fire, and the dude just started pulling up for threes, and the last three he hit, and I think Marv Albert was on the call. It was amazing. And the last three he hit was like the classic Steph Curry, like he's in transition, and he penetrates, and he does the backup dribble three times, and then pulls up for three with one on four and hits it. That was great. And my second memory is not what you would expect. I would, you know, that game 6 against Dallas was really, really cool. It doesn't really have an individual moment that stood out. But in 2004, when Wade was a rookie, we played Dallas. Again, it was Dallas on like a Friday night on ESPN, which is a rare event for that team. And Rafer Alston, skip to my Lou, hit a three at the buzzer at home, falling to his left off an inbounds pass, and that team was super fun to watch. They never won a title, but that team was like Wade, Odom, Eddie Jones, Rafer Alston, Caron Butler. That was a good team and fun team to watch, even though we traded everything for Shaq. So none of those guys were as good in the Lakers as they were in the Heat, Ollie.
I don't know. Lamar Odom did well. I think it worked out for both franchises in the end. So I'm a big Shaq guy, so it was sad to see him go, but it was it needed to happen, it looked like.
Well, guys, enjoy, be safe. Hopefully things are better the next time we talk. And thanks for again taking that time to do this during a tough time.
Thanks for having us, Jay.
No problem. Thanks for having us.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. 223 episodes are found there, sorted by category, including this one. Great resource. Use right now during these times where you may have more downtime. You may want to do some education. If you want to claim CME with all the meetings that have been canceled recently, the American Academy of Ophthalmology is offering in general about a half credit of CME for episodes that qualify, which is most of them. That dates back to our first episode if you want to go back and claim credits and listen. You can find us on Twitter and on Facebook at Retina Podcast. You can contact us by emailing me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com or by clicking on the contact us on our website. Remember that you can get updates on the most recent episodes by subscribing in your mobile device in the Android store or Apple store, and you can also subscribe directly on our website. There's a little area to enter your email address to get updates. We love ideas and stories from how you're doing. If there's anything specifically about COVID-19 you want to hear about or you want to talk about, please reach out to me. Thank you so much to Dr. Khan and Dr. Kurian for joining me. Thank you to Jen Ford and the team at PentaVision for providing the articles for Retinal Physician in Advance. Thank you to Dr. Angela Chang, Dr. Louis Kai, and Dr. Mike Benacasa for everything they do for the podcast and for continuing to serve on the front lines in their respective residencies during COVID-19. And thank you, listeners, for everything you're doing and everything you're doing in your practices. I know it's been a very difficult time, regardless of your practice setting, academic, private, whether you're part of a hospital system. This has been a very, very difficult time for all American citizens, for all physicians, and for ophthalmologists especially. And, you know, once listening here, I know you all felt some sort of pressure and stress from this. So again, stay safe, be well. As I will end with a quote from the Bhagavad Gita before closing. When meditation is mastered, the mind is unwavering like the flame of a lamp in a windless place. In the still mind, in the depths of meditation, the self reveals itself. Beholding the self by means of the self, an aspirant knows the joy and peace of complete fulfillment. Having attained that abiding joy is beyond the senses. Revealed in the still mind, he never swerves from the eternal truth. Headspace is offering free subscriptions for anyone with an NPI number. I never really was into meditation, but it's something I've done recently. And during this time, it's really helped me at least stay level. I know other people commented it's helped. Be well, be safe. We'll see you next week.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.